With It Says in the Papers, here's Caroline Murphy.
Setback for hopes of recovery as state enters recession. That's the headline on the front of the Irish Times today. We're told that in the first 3 months of this year, the fall in consumer spending on the previous quarter was the largest on record, while the decline in exports was the second biggest since figures were first compiled in 1997. Bad news on the front of the Irish Examiner this morning too. It's more on the drug stories in yesterday's news. Today the headline is, high cost of drugs sees rise in sale of fake pills. We're told that a Europe-wide crackdown on the sale of black market medications found more than 192,000 types of illegal drugs in Irish border searches. Fia Crowe Cunney says the potentially dangerous medications were seized last week and are estimated to be worth €612,000. And he says the Irish Patients Association said prices, not ignorance, are forcing people to buy illegally online. It's the price of health cover, meanwhile, which makes the lead story in the Irish Independent today. Charlie Weston says a new breed of no-frills health insurance is set to ignite a price war between providers for the first time in years. He says insurance giants are poised to offer a range of stripped-down plans for a reduced price in a bid to stem the flow of thousands of young families giving up medical cover. Inside, in a comment piece, Weston says of the prospect, it's the best piece of news hard-pressed families have had in ages. The downside, he says, is that not all hospitals will be covered and that some procedures will not be covered. But he says the hope is that the price war will have the effect of slowing down the number of families giving up their health insurance. Giving up on hope and then life, it appears, Philip Wood. The Irish Daily Mail and the Irish Sun lead with, and the other papers give front page space to the deaths of Mr. Wood, his wife and his daughter in Spain. Sorry, says the Mirror. He thought it was the only way out, is the headline in the Mail. Father's note said caring for family was too much, says the one in the Examiner. And husband left note after shooting Irish wife and daughter, says the Irish Daily Star. We're told Sheila Wood was ill and that daughter Sophie required full-time care. The number of girls in state care here, meanwhile, who travelled abroad for abortions in the past 20 years gets attention in the Times today. Six girls under the age of 18 in state care were assisted in travelling abroad for abortions on suicide grounds, says Mary Minahan in a front page story. She says the figure was revealed by Minister Francis Fitzgerald in the Dáil yesterday in response to a parliamentary question from Billy Timmins, who, the paper also reports, announced yesterday that he would vote against the proposed abortion bill. That Angela Merkel response to the Anglo tapes makes news this morning. The Independent finds front page space to report those comments in Brussels yesterday. I cannot but express my contempt at this, we're told, she said. And the Independent front page also finds space to reflect the outpouring of goodwill and affection towards Nelson Mandela as crowds gathered in Pretoria. Some, says Daniel Howden, had come to wish him well, others to say goodbye, and others to make a final withdrawal from his immense political capital.
Thank you very much, Caroline. 11 minutes past seven, and Conor Brophy's here with the business news. Morning, Conor.
Morning, Colin. It might come as something of a surprise given some of the events of the past week, but Ireland's reputation among the general public in 50 different countries has improved over the past year, according to the latest global RepTrack survey. Ireland is the 12th most reputable country in the world, improving from 15th place in 2012. I suppose probably next year's list will be the interesting one to watch. That might reflect the impact of the US Senate subcommittee on investigations about tax and maybe some of the Anglo stuff as well, so we look for it in 2013. But for the time being, anyway, we're ahead of the US, the UK, Japan and Brazil, among others. That report looks at perceptions of how countries rank on a number of criteria, including business climate, attractiveness as a tourism destination, effectiveness of government and environmental awareness. Negotiations will begin with the European Parliament shortly on putting in place new rules on how EU member states will deal with failing banks after yesterday's agreement among EU finance ministers. That sets out that shareholders, junior bondholders, senior bondholders and then depositors with amounts greater than €100,000 in their accounts will take the pain in that order instead of taxpayers being first in line. A new report by PricewaterhouseCoopers estimates the probability of discovering oil or gas is just 1 in 32 for each round of exploration in Ireland. That compares to 1 in 6 in the UK and 1 in 7 in Norway. As the average cost of sinking a single well is around €100 million, that would imply €3.2 billion is spent by exploration companies for every one success. successful well here. Ingvar Kamprad, one of the world's richest people, is moving back to his home country of Sweden, having left for Switzerland 40 years ago complaining of high taxes. He's the founder and owner of IKEA. He's now 76 and he's moving back home, he says, to be closer to his family. The flat-pack furniture king has an estimated fortune of 40 billion euro, which makes him the second richest person in Europe behind his fellow retail billionaire Amancio Ortega of the fashion chain Zara. He's also the fourth richest person in the world. And all those euros he has this morning, trading at just over $1.30 and 85.6 pence sterling.
Thanks a million, Connor. It's 13 minutes past seven. Coming up, Angela Merkel's take on the Anglo-bankers. Contempt, that's the word used by Angela Merkel overnight to describe her attitude towards the Anglo-Irish telephone tapes the German Chancellor was speaking at the Summit of European Leaders in Brussels. Here's exactly what she said when asked about those tapes.
Die ihr Geld verdienen. Einfach nur ganz, ganz
it's hard to digest for those who go to work every day.
Und das ist eine richtige Schädigung der Demokratie.
It is damaging democracy, social market economy and everything we strive for.
Und deshalb ist das auch für uns eine unglaubliche Herausforderung, weil zu die
that's why it's an incredible challenge for us to convince people who get up every morning to do their work, who always pay taxes, who even show solidarity with others who are weaker. It is damaging. This is why I regard this with contempt.
Angela Merkel, our Europe editor Tony Connolly is on the line from Brussels. Tony, the German papers have already given their views on the sort of attitudes revealed on those tapes. Now Angela Merkel has had her say.
That's right. She was asked about the Anglo tapes last night and we just heard her comments there. I mean, this is the last EU summit before the German elections and she is nothing if not relentlessly mindful of the concerns of German taxpayers, not to say German voters. And she was very clear in her views there that this was contemptible, especially for people who, as she says, get up, go to work every day, earn their money, pay their taxes. I mean, that's a very intrinsically Angela Merkel view of the world. She sees the world in those terms, and clearly she didn't hold back on her comments last night.
Mind you, I think her comments might chime with the views of a lot of people in this country who would say to you, listen, here I am slogging away every day and then I hear something like this. And again, similar sentiments have been expressed here over the past few days, that this sense almost that people were laughing at them.
That's right. I mean, there was a lot of expectation, certainly among the Irish media yesterday at the summit, as to whether or not Angela Merkel would refer to the Anglo tapes, and she clearly has done so. And I would suspect that she was prepared to get the question because, you know, I've been speaking to some German officials about this. And earlier in the week in Luxembourg, you know, the story was kind of just breaking. But by Wednesday, it was an international story and was covered to some extent in the German press. So people certainly are aware of it. Taoiseach Enda Kenny spoke to Angela Merkel on Wednesday by telephone. Now, I was trying to establish yesterday, speaking to at least three officials, some of them very senior figures in the government, whether or not the issue had been raised between the two leaders on the telephone, and they either said they didn't know or said that it wasn't raised. And we've just had confirmation this morning, a short time ago, from a government spokesman that the issue didn't come up yesterday at any level at the summit, either on the margins between the Taoiseach and Angela Merkel or in any formal setting during the summit. But there you are. She has made her comments known and they're again being widely reported this morning.
Officially, Tony, what's happening at the summit today?
Well, the main action was yesterday, and it started with the breakthrough in the EU budget talks. The EU budget will run for 7 years from next year, 960 billion euro. There was a bit of a deadlock because the European Parliament still hadn't approved the budget, and they were looking for a lot of flexibility in how money is spent between years. Basically, you have the EU the budget ceiling, and then you have the actual payments that usually come under that, and what the Parliament had been looking for was to have the leftover money rolled over so that it could be spent in subsequent years. And there was a formula agreed under the Irish presidency, a lot of late night negotiating and telephone calls going on during the week. And I suppose that was the start of the summit yesterday. That has been received political agreement, at least from the heads of the European Parliament, and it'll go to a formal vote next week. So that meant that there were other issues which could then be opened up, and the principal one, I guess, is the €6 billion for youth employment. It's become a big political issue for European governments now. Huge numbers of European young people are unemployed, some 25% altogether, facing joblessness across Europe. The €6 billion has been front-loaded, so it'll be spent over the next 2 years, and it's tied in with what's called a youth guarantee scheme. And that's the idea, at least, that any young person should be given either a job or training or an apprenticeship within 4 months of losing a job. Now, that's obviously a very big, ambitious concept, and it needs money behind it. A lot of people have said that €6 billion isn't enough, but there you are, it's been front-loaded, so it will be available over the next 2 years.
Tony, thank you very much for that. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, in Brussels this morning will have further reaction to Angela Merkel's comments later on in the programme.
The country's fallen back into recession, a dismal fact just confirmed by official figures for last year and the first 3 months of this, and against predictions of low growth by forecasters in the Department of Finance and elsewhere. We're joined by one of them who was with us in January when, in fairness, his growth forecast was on the very low side, as he predicted no meaningful growth for 2 years last year. It's now clear that his forecasts were closest to being right. Tom Neary of the Nevin Institute, good morning and congratulations for this.
Thank you.
Correctness of your forecasts. Now, the latest figures from the CSO yesterday tell you what, or change what, if anything, as to how you view where we're going to be for the next 2 years?
Yes, well, clearly the present course of policy is not working, and we need a change of policy and direction. Obviously, we need to be careful about provisional data, particularly quarterly data. However, the overall trend is clear. Since about the middle of last year, the economy is stalling, and this is impacting on consumption and on investment. It reflects, obviously, European austerity and Irish austerity, among other factors.
Would you hold to your view, then, that you explained to us in January that there's going to be nothing meaningful in terms of growth for the next 2 years?
It's unlikely that growth will exceed 1% or 2% per annum this year or next year. And there's a real possibility that the economy could flatline this year, even if there is a bounce back in the second, third and fourth quarters, which is beginning to look increasingly unlikely.
Meaning what, in your view, for the calculations for the next budget due in October and the possibility of a second bailout?
Too early to say on a bailout. I think the prospects still are positive in terms of exiting the current bailout arrangement such as it is. But I think the government does have options here in terms of the budgetary correction next autumn. And certainly I think the promissory note deal needs to be utilised to the maximum to ease the fiscal consolidation. If we think of it this way, June 2014, what will we be looking at in terms of personal consumption, investment and overall public finances? There's a very real possibility that if the government proceeds with a €3 billion fiscal adjustment this autumn, the figures could be worse next year. We don't know. I think the most prudent, safest course of action and the quickest way to bring down the government deficit is to ease back on fiscal consolidation and to couple that with an investment stimulus. That actually could reach a 3% deficit target by 2015.
What would you spend the money on?
Well, the first thing is to stop cutting in health, education and social welfare. And here I'm talking about non-pay current expenditure. The government seems to be earmarking approximately €1.3 billion of cuts, roughly, on the non-pay side. If they go ahead with that, it's going to do a lot of damage economically, socially, personally, for communities and individuals. So that's the first thing I think that needs to be said. Indeed, the most effective stimulus overall is social welfare, because consumers and households have a higher propensity to consume compared to higher income households.
What are you saying, put up social welfare?
I think there could be a case for doing that, but I think the first point is to actually hold the line in terms of the nominal primary social welfare
right.
rates.
Back to the word investment. You would invest mm-hmm. in what? On what kind of thing?
Principally areas such as water infrastructure, broadband, renewable energy, among others. Social infrastructure is also very important. Investment in early childhood education and care, youth guarantee has been mentioned already.
Now, what do you say? I mean, all of this, who could possibly disagree with any of this if we had the money and if we weren't running risks by spending it? What do you say to those, and there are many of them in your profession, the economics profession, who say, we're on the edge of a cliff. Things are not looking good. Best to do what needs to be done, just in case things go even more wrong than they've already gone.
Well, there is a little bit of life left in the economy still. Let's not kill it. And I think presently we're looking at financial emergency legislation coming before the Oireachtas, measures in the public interest is described. Whatever one thinks about the merits or otherwise of this measure, I'd suggest we have a jobs and growth emergency, and measures are needed there in the public interest. And in terms of an investment stimulus, one immediate source of possible revenue is the proceeds of the sales of the Bank of Ireland cocoa bonds and Irish Life and Permanent together. About $2.5 billion in cash reserves have been added as a result of those sales. Some of that money could be mobilised within the next 30 months, for example, to invest in some of those priority areas.
And you're saying don't worry about the risk of things getting even worse?
I'm very concerned about the risk of actually not changing the present course of action. And that means that we need to actually focus on a different kind of budgetary adjustment.
Right. Tom Neary of the Nevin Institute, thank you very much. 7:26.
South Africans have been holding an all-night prayer vigil outside the one-time home of Nelson Mandela. The 94-year-old is clinging to life in a Pretoria hospital. Yesterday, the former president's eldest daughter, Makaziwe, accused the media, who are camped outside that hospital, of violating her father's privacy. Our correspondent, Richard Downes, is in South Africa. Richard, have there been any updates overnight?
No, very little, Rachel. The condition of the elder statesman remains the same. He's in a critical condition, but they say he's stable, and there has been some improvement in the past 24 hours. The updates on his health come fairly sporadically in the region of once every 24 hours or so. We'll get an update at some stage, I presume, later today. But of course, everybody's very anxious about his health, and I suppose it's fair to say that he's been in hospital now for some almost 3 weeks, I think, at this stage, since the 8th of June. So he's been in hospital for a long time in a very serious or critical condition, and I suppose people are resigned to the fact that the 94-year-old is in a very difficult situation, that his lung infection has not improved, and people are resigned that things may not get any better.
Barack Obama is due in South Africa today. Is it in any way clear at this stage how this visit is going to be handled?
No, it's not, and it's quite a thing for the authorities here to try and handle and to manage. Barack Obama himself, of course, who was in Senegal, describing President Mandela as a hero of the world and saying that his legacy will linger on right through the ages. Now, from what we understand, there are plans B and plan C, as there always are when there's an American presidential visit abroad, and extraordinary resources have gone in to this Barack Obama's visit to Africa. The order of $100 million has been spent in preparing for his visit, not just here, of course, but also to Tanzania, and he's been in Senegal earlier. So there are plans B and plan C. There is no plan for President Obama to visit Nelson Mandela, but I suppose the optics of all of this, with the U.S. president and all that goes with him, the entourage and the military preparations and the security around him, there is a sense, I suppose, in South Africa when you talk to people that they feel that that would be unseemly and a wrong kind of message to send out with such a beloved leader in such a delicate condition, and perhaps even worse, in hospital. And there are many people scratching their heads and trying to figure out how this visit is going to pan out.
Richard, thanks indeed for that. Richard Downes, who's in South Africa for us this morning. 8:26. Des Cahill joins us with the sport. Morning, Des.
Good morning to you, Rachel. Really busy weekend, and day two of the Irish Open Golf has just got underway in Kildare. Irish hopes are high. Here's Greg Allen.
A really strong Irish challenge brightened up a damp grey day one, after which a Swede, Oscar Florin, who's never won on the main tour, leads on 6 under par 66, one ahead of a group of five men on 5 under, which includes Michael Hoey and Shane Lowry. And Hoey actually tees off in the next few minutes in round two, hoping to put behind him a desperate run of form and repeat what he did yesterday in a really steady round of 67.
You know, if I can just keep cruising along, basically, instead of being up and down, just keep cruising. Today, only one bogey, so that's what the plan is, just make a lot of pars and if a few putts drop, that would be good. And the swing has to repeat, and the swing was repeating today.
It's a late tee-off time of 10-1 for Lowry, who lives on site here at Carton, and he knows what to expect this weekend on this wide-open course with up to 25-mile-an-hour winds forecast tomorrow and Sunday.
I mean, this is a tough golf course in any type of conditions, especially when it's windy. And, you know, obviously the course will suit me if it is windy, but, you know, I'd still have to play good golf. But if I play as good as I played today, you know, it shouldn't be any problem.
Lowry and Hoey are in a five-way tie for second on 5-under. Monkstown Club Pro Kian McNamara is 4-under after a dream round of 68. There were 69s for Simon Thornton and West Waterford's Seamus Power, 70s for Paul McGinley and Alan Dunbar, and 71s for Graham McDowell, Padraig Harrington and Gareth Maben. But Rory McIlroy is outside the top 100 on 2-over par after a 74.
All right, Greg. Well, Spain will play Brazil in Sunday's Confederation Cup final after the European and World Champions beat Italy 7-6 on penalties last night following a nil-all draw. That final, by the way, 10:45 on Sunday night in RT2. The Sunday game starts at 8:30. League of Ireland action resumes tonight. Five games in the Premier Division. St. Pat's host Bray. It's Derry City versus Bowes, UCD versus Cork City, Drogheda versus Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne versus Sligo Rovers. It's possibly the busiest championship weekend of the GA season, and unusually the action gets underway tonight. A big crowd expected at Dr. Cullen Park when the footballers of Carlow take on neighbours Laois in the qualifiers. Now, Kevin McStay is looking ahead to the week action. We'll talk about the four provincial semi-finals later in the programme. But first, the qualifiers. What about Carlow versus Laois?
Laois, in a word, I don't think either team has great prospects in the qualifier. I think their teams are looking at, a lot of their players are looking at club championship or the USA at this stage, and their morale is low. It's a historic fixture, but it's one that Laois should win tidily enough.
Into Saturday then, Offaly against Tyrone.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because the injury list, Stephen O'Neill is now on it, and as you know, Niall Morgan is out. But Tyrone are fairly decent as against Donegal, even though Offaly were quite decent against Kildare. If the Tyrone injuries tidy up, I go for Tyrone. I mean, it would be a disaster for Tyrone not to win it. Offaly are at home and they'll contest this very well and they'll give it a good shot, but it has to be Tyrone.
Louth at home to Antrim.
You haven't watched Antrim. I thought Antrim were the poorest team in the 2013 Championship. And Louth, they're lucky. They have a home venue and they've drawn Antrim. So I think Louth, decent against Wexford, I fancy they will relaunch and they'll have a bit of a qualifier run.
Westmeath at home to Fermanagh.
Similar to the Louth game, I thought Fermanagh had real prospects against Cavan when I watched them 2 weeks ago, but they didn't score for, I think, 25 minutes. Now, I think they'll improve and they'll rectify that against the Westmeath team, well beaten by Dublin. And I think the away win is on the cards here for Fermanagh.
Longford at home to Limerick.
Believe it or not, Des, Longford haven't won a competitive game in 2013. I know they're hard to beat in Pierce Park, but I think Limerick will continue the 2013 nightmare for Longford. I think Limerick will win it.
All right, Galway at home to Tipperary.
Injury is a big concern for Galway. Galway football, not in a good place. They have to stand up and do something about it. I think the Tipperary match offers them that chance. If the injuries don't clear up, they're in real trouble. Tipperary could sneak it, but on the assumption that the injuries do clear up, I'm giving it to Galway by 2 or 3 points.
Armagh at home to Wicklow.
Well, I think Armagh are a team that will get a run in the qualifiers. I know they got heavily criticised for the defeat against Cavan. They'll have learned a lot. Wicklow had their chance against Meath down in Aucrim, but too many errors at key times. Armagh to win it 3 or 4 points.
And finally, Derry versus Sligo.
I think a lot of people think Sligo are, you know, maybe dead men walking, perhaps. Very hard to see him turning it around after a defeat to London. Like, that's a shocker of a result. Derry played well against Down. Derry are at home again, and I give them the nod.
All right, thanks, Kevin. Now, the All-Ireland Hurling Champions Kilkenny have made three changes for tomorrow's Real Play with Dublin. Jackie Tyrrell in for the injured Paul Murphy, TJ Reid in for Lester Ryan, and Aidan Fogarty in for Colin Fenley. For a verdict on the hurling, let's hear from Michael Deignan. Have Dublin blown their chance?
Well, I don't think necessarily so. You know, normally in a replay like this, you'd say, you know, the reigning All-Ireland champions, and Kilkenny traditionally in replays will be very strong. But, you know, there are a few creaks appearing. There have a lot of injuries. You know, the likes of Jackie Turley coming back, but Paul Murphy, Michael Fenley, Henry Shefflin, you know, and they're not going to be back for a while. And a bit of mileage beginning to show. So I think, you know, I expected a big show from Dublin last week, and I think the very same thing is going to happen. It's going to be a very tight game, and I wouldn't be surprised if Dublin won it, but you'd expect maybe Kilkenny will have, the pressure is really, really on them, and they'll want to avoid Tipperary in the qualifiers, as will Dublin, but maybe Kilkenny to shade it, but not saying that with any great confidence.
And then we have the qualifiers. Wexford play Carlow.
Yeah, well, Wexford, you know, got back on track last week. A good win against Antrim in the end, got a couple of late goals, and you know, you expect Wexford to come through. Carlow had a great win against Dublin in the Under 21 Championship this year, and beating the other night in the semi final, but making progress, but you'd expect Wexford to come through on that one.
And then Waterford go to Westmeath.
Yeah, again, Westmeath went over to London, scraped through there, and Waterford, very impressive, I thought, in the last 20 minutes against Offaly last Saturday, and I was at the match, playing into the wind with 20 minutes to go. It was all square, and they finished very, very strongly with Morris Shannon really coming of age with 13.8 from play, and, you know, they did very well. A few creaks in their defence, but you'd expect Waterford to come through that one easily.
And up in Ulster, Michael, Antrim are awaiting the winners of Derry and Down in the semi-final.
Yeah, you know, probably, again, 50-50 game, maybe just in Down's favour.
OK, thanks, Michael. In tennis, after the drama of Wednesday, yesterday a quiet day at Wimbledon, Serena Williams winning easily, and Novak Djokovic beat the American Bobby Reynolds in three sets. And that means, an extraordinary stat, that for the first time since 1912, no American man plays in the third round of Wimbledon. In rugby, the Aussie captain James Horwell will face a citing hearing again after the IRB appealed the decision to not to penalise him for stamping on Alan Wynne-Jones, but he can play in the second test tomorrow. Ireland's Brian Regan ran a very good fourth in a top-class 400 metres race in the Czech Republic last night. The Irish show jumpers were fifth in the Nations Cup in Aachen, and the Irish Derby Festival meeting gets underway at the Curragh this evening, beginning at 5:25. The Derby itself will be run tomorrow. We'll be previewing that later in the programme, and it'll be part of a six-hour-long Saturday sport here on Radio 1 that also features the Irish Open Golf and all of the GA tomorrow.
6 hours.
We do it a lot of Saturdays, actually, but tomorrow there's a lot in it.
We're in the happy place. Des, thank you very much. It's 18 minutes to 8. In Washington, last night, the Senate passed a substantial overhaul of America's immigration laws. Now, this isn't the final step towards reform, but important nevertheless as a pointer to the way the political wind is blowing across the pond in what is a pre-election year. John Sinniff of USA Today spoke to us earlier.
One of the biggest things it does is that we have, it's believed to be 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country now, many obviously from Mexico and Central America. And that's been the biggest question, is what do we do with those people? Well, this actually provides a pathway to citizenship for all of those people. And it's not without consequence. They have to jump through many hoops. They would have to really get to the back of the line. It would be a years-long process. And they'd have to pay back taxes and things like that. So it isn't, again, it's not just amnesty, which has really become fighting words in the immigration discussions in this country. One of the biggest things, and it happened first, it includes billions for border security upgrades, doubling the number of border patrol agents, for instance. And it's really a very thick and a lot of money involved in this bill.
So that's what would happen if the bill were passed. Now, it's gone through the Senate, but what does that mean in terms of it, of the final shape of legislation when the House of Representatives has considered the issue?
Well, the Republican-controlled House has made it very clear, and House Speaker John Boehner himself has said, this bill is not going anywhere. We are not going to put to a vote the Senate bill. And what that means is that it doesn't mean that the Senate bill itself is dead, that those parts, you know, aren't going to at some point have life again. But what it means is that the House will have its own version of this bill. And if they're close, they can go to what's called conference and kind of come to some sort of a compromise. But the Republicans, the language they're using on this, it sounds like no one has the appetite for something this large. I mean, this would be the biggest immigration reform bill since Ronald Reagan, since 1986. This is a massive piece of legislation, and no one thought it could be done. Well, it might not get done. But the fact is, Republicans in the House, they're really walking a tight wire on this, because with the growth of Latinos in this country and the support, and we've had USA Today's done polling very recently that shows much greater support now than just 5, 6, 7 years ago for this type of massive reform. If they don't handled this well in 2014 and the presidential election in 2016, they really could pay dearly.
Your newspaper, USA Today, is leading on this this morning. You clearly believe this is significant, even though it's not a done deal.
Even though it's not a done deal, the fact that it passed 68-32 vote in the Senate, that is very significant for a couple reasons. One, all the Democrats, and that was expected, would vote for it. This is, after all, the president's bill, and the president has had a big part in this. But you also pulled along 14 Republicans, so they have the stamp of a bipartisan bill. That's a big deal because, as you know, in Washington over the past 10 years, you don't get a lot of things done with both parties working hand in hand. And in the Senate, in this case, it's pretty close to as good as it gets.
And in terms of the likely possible timetable for legislation to emerge, finally, next year is an election year. Would you expect this to be sorted one way or the other within the next 12 months?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, as quickly as it's moving, the House even said that July 10th they're going to convene and try to draft their own legislation on this and start moving forward with it. So the inertia is there. The will is there. Clearly it's done in the Senate. The House is really where we're going to have to sit back. But if this dies and if the House doesn't get anything done with it, don't expect the Senate bill to go anywhere for a good time. It may be until the midterm elections in 2014 before there's movement on this again.
John, before we let you go, there has been a deal of information about the charges, first of all, that one of the man facing trial now in connection with the Boston bombings, about the background to this, what he's been, what charges he's facing, and also about some of his own thoughts just before he was arrested.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dukar Tsarnaev, it's a 30-count indictment that came out today. And we've known a lot of what happened, how the bombs were made. A lot of this has been reported. But if you read this indictment, and it's a very long, very detailed indictment, it goes to the planning of this. It goes through every detail, every moment, through the police chase, the waiting, all of this. It says which bombs and which explosions killed who. And it really is kind of the tale of this. A couple things are really fascinating about this. One, it happened in the state of Massachusetts, which does not have the death penalty, but this is a federal charge. So this 19-year-old absolutely could face the death penalty, and there's a good chance that he will. And as you alluded to, right before he was found, he had etched a couple things or written inside that boat. And the details of that are in this indictment. And he said, quote, "The U.S. government is killing our innocent civilians. I can't stand to see such evil go unpunished. We Muslims are one body. You hurt one, you hurt us all. Now, I don't like killing innocent people. It is forbidden in Islam. But due to said," and you can't hear what he says, or what he wrote, "it is allowed. Stop killing our innocent people, and we will stop." It's really chilling language, and after having read through a good portion of this indictment, I tell you, it is. I would not want to be his defense attorney. It's really an astounding amount of evidence against this man.
And that's John Sinniff of USA Today. 12 minutes to 8.
King John's Castle in Limerick will reopen to the public today after an extensive revamp. It's hoped the new features will help to draw more visitors to the city. John Ruddle is Chief Executive of Shannon Heritage, and he's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
For people who don't know the castle, what's its significance to Limerick?
Well, it's hugely significant, Rachel. The castle was built around about 1200, so it stood there for a huge amount of time. And of course, its existence through all the different ages represents, I suppose, a piece of history right the way through all the decades, all the centuries. And what's great this week is that excitement has been building all week in Limerick that we're reopening the castle after it had been closed for a year. And we've moved it from what I would describe as a bit of a tired experience to a very, very exciting experience for visitors. And we're hoping to draw visitors from a lot of different international countries to Limerick to see the new exhibition.
What sort of difference then will visitors notice? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah, what we've decided to do is use a whole raft of different interpretive methods to create excitement for the visitor. We're not using traditional methods at all. What we're doing is we're using a lot of interactive screens with games and quizzes. We've a lot of dress up areas where children and adults can dress up and have themselves photographed, and just a bit of fun. We've discovery drawers. We've got some museum artifacts, things that were found during the archaeological digs back in the 1990s. We've even got a siege tunnel, so we've recreated a 1642 siege tunnel, mainly for children to crawl through and feel what it might have been like back in those times.
Well, under the ground. That sounds great. Are adults welcome to crawl as well, or do you have to be small to do it?
Not at all. This is about fun for everybody, and adults are very, very welcome to do it as well. Of course, we have another great attraction, which is a cannonball game for children, and of course, the adults will no doubt take part in that as well and compete against the children to see how many walls of the castle they can knock down in the game.
How has the season been going in the Midwest, John? I mean, are you noticing extra visitors this year?
We definitely are, Rachel. It's been an extremely difficult few years for tourism, for everybody across the country and across the Midwest. There's no exception to that. But thankfully this year, we really are seeing signs of improvement, particularly on the international markets, particularly for USA visitors. We're seeing an awful lot more USA visitors in the West this year. And of course, we're hoping an awful lot of those will come to King John's over the next few weeks.
Well, listen, many thanks for taking the time to have a few words with us this morning. John Ruddle there, Chief Executive of Shannon Heritage. It's 8 minutes to 8 o'clock. Time next for the Business News Winner.
Rachel, I mentioned at 7:10 how difficult it is to find oil and gas in Ireland. PricewaterhouseCoopers putting the chances of a successful discovery at 1 in 32 for each round of exploration versus 1 in 6 in the UK and 1 in 7 in Norway. Good news on that front from the Irish firm Petrel this morning, though, as it signed what's known as a farm-out agreement. They're very common in oil and gas exploration, and it involves a smaller company doing the early groundwork. When it finds a promising prospect, it then brings in a bigger partner. In this case, Petrel has brought in Australia's largest independent oil and gas company, Woodside. It'll take an 85% share of Petrel's Porcupine Basin holding off the Atlantic coast. Ireland is the 12th most reputable country in the world, up from 15th last year, according to the latest Country RepTrack survey undertaken by the Reputation Institute. It collates views of the general public in 50 countries around the world. Niamh Boyle is the Managing Director of Corporate Reputations, which is the Irish associate of the Reputation Institute. Niamh, what criteria are reflected here? What's in a reputation?
Well, a reputation is made up of very many indicators, but the three key dimensions that we would look at would be, does this country have an effective government? Does it have an appealing environment? And does it have an advanced economy? And that's really where the indicators would lie.
What's made the difference between 15th last year and 12th this year then? Where has Ireland improved?
Well, this year, Ireland has done well. We've remained the same or better across all 25 indicators, which is very, very good, particularly when we see that most countries in the world have fallen in terms of their reputation, where we've improved by about 2 points. So the best performing indicators for us have been we are seen as a favourable environment for doing business. We're seen to be run by an effective government, and we're also seen to operate efficiently. And that means that we are perceived to not impose unnecessary taxes or to waste resources at government level. So they're all very positive indicators for Ireland.
Does it make any difference though what that type of view reflects? I mean, to coin a phrase, where's the moolah? Does it make a difference where your reputation is from the point of view of the bottom line?
It should absolutely make a difference. Countries, just like companies, with good reputations get all the support, and so there should be a strong economic impact from Ireland raising its reputation. It increases competitiveness, it increases the ability to export, it means that the country should welcome more tourists, it improves political diplomacy, something that's extremely important at the moment, coming to the end of our Irish presidency, and attracts FDI. And particularly in an environment where tourism, FDI, international trade are all due to grow by a small percentage points over the next number of years. Ireland wants a share of that, and this gives us an opportunity to take that.
It's worth noting, though, that the surveys here took place, I think, earlier on this year, so it would have missed out, for example, the whole tax haven debate, and of course it would have missed out the Anglo tapes and so on over the past week. So I guess 2013 will be an interesting one to watch.
Yes, it should
be. Or 2014.
Be. Yeah. The research takes place in January and February every year, so it really depends on how long a memory Europeans have, or the G8 countries have, of Ireland by next January. But so far, so good. We're on the rise.
Niamh Boyle of Corporate Reputations, thanks very much for coming into us this morning. Just finally for now, in currency news, the euro trading just over at $1.30 this morning and a shade ahead of 85.5 pence sterling.
Thank you very much, Conor. Coming up to 4 minutes to 8, time for the forecast from Owen Sherlock of Met Aaron. Owen, good morning.
Thank you, and a very good morning from Met Aaron. Well, rain and drizzle in parts of the north and the west will spread southeastwards to the rest of the country during the morning and the afternoon, but amounts will tend to be small. It's going to be a cloudy and mild day with highs of 14 to 17 degrees in general, but for Leinster and South Munster, it's going to be warmer with highs of 16 to 20 degrees. Winds will be moderate westerly. For most of the country, it's going to be a dry start tonight, but more patchy rain and drizzle will move into the west, and this will then begin to spread eastwards across the country. It's going to be a mild, misty and cloudy night with lows of 10 to 14 degrees in light winds. Outbreaks of rain will continue to spread northeastwards across the country on Saturday morning and afternoon. However, a clearance to drier and brighter weather will develop in the southwest during the early afternoon, and this will slowly extend to all areas during the rest of the day. Mild and humid with highs of 16 to 21 degrees. Saturday night will be cloudy with mist and drizzle affecting western and northern coastal parts. For the rest of the country, it's going to stay dry. Another mild and close night with lows of 12 or 13 degrees. And now the outlook. On Sunday, a weak front will spread across the country, but rainfall amounts will be small and parts of the southeast may remain dry all day with the best of any sunshine. It's going to be a cloudy day though, with moderate southwest winds and highs of 16 to 20 degrees. During Sunday night, more light rain and drizzle will affect western and northern coasts, and we can expect lows of 8 to 11 degrees. It's going to remain cloudy for much of the country on Monday, with light rain affecting parts of Connacht and Ulster. Later in the evening, a band of rain will move into the west, and this will spread eastwards overnight. Highs on Monday of 15 to 18 degrees. The rain will clear the east coast on Tuesday afternoon, with some brighter spells developing. It's going to be a little bit cooler though, with highs of only 14 to 17 degrees in moderate westerly winds. So a quick recap for today. Cloudy and misty with outbreaks of light rain and drizzle, highs of 14 to 17 degrees in general, but it's going to be warmer in Leinster and South Munster. And that's the forecast. A very good morning.